All right, the court is here today to consider a habeas appeal, ex parte Tanya Couch. Panel consists of myself, Justice Birdwell to my left, Justice Womack to my right, Justice Basil, and everybody I think has checked in, so I will let the clerk call the case.
Court will now call ex parte Tanya Couch. May it please the court, Mr. Mark Bennett will argue for the appellate, Ms. Andrea Jacobs will argue for the state.
Who's gonna step up, Mr. Bennett?
Wait for the invitation, Justice Birdwell. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May it please the court.
Sure.
My name is Mark Bennett, and along with Stephanie Patton, I represent Tanya Couch. This is the appeal of the denial of habeas challenging a thought crime. In preparing for my argument, I realized that there was an angle that I hadn't taken in my briefs, and I want to offer the court a couple of other cases that have come up from my researching that in the last couple of hours. The state's position here is and has to be that intending to do something is conduct, is an actus reus. So I thought, well, have Texas courts ever said that intending to do something is a mens rea? Because that's our position, that intending to do something is a mens rea, which gives this statute two mentis reae, two mens reas, and so makes it a thought crime. And what I found was Ruffin versus the state, which is 270 Southwest 3rd, 586 at 594, and that's Court of Criminal Appeals 2008, in which the Court of Criminal Appeals said the defendant intended to shoot at a police officer, and that is enough proof of mens rea, that the intention is the mens rea. Similarly, this court in Smith versus State, 187 Southwest 3rd, 186 at 194, in 2006, Pett refused, described intended as mens rea. The position that the state is trying to take here is that while intent might describe mens rea, intended is an act. If intended is an act, then thought is also an act. To think is an act. If to intend is an act, then to think is an act. To hope is an act. To wish is an act, because all of these things take the act of participation, albeit no bodily conduct. To not love Big Brother actively is an act. To plan to disobey Big Brother is an act. To intend to disobey Big Brother is an act. This is not the law in Texas, nor indeed in the common law system. Historically, an actus reus and a mens rea both have been required to form a crime. The mens rea is the thought behind the act. The actus reus is the wrong act, the bad act. In this case, the Texas legislature has written a statute that contains two mens reas and no bad act. It's a crime.
But doesn't Section 6.01A of the Penal Code provide the act?
Section 6.01A, and I may not have the statute number right, but it says in order for there to be a crime, there has to be conduct.
It says a person commits an offense only if he voluntarily engages in conduct, including an act, an omission, or possession.
Yes. And the Texas legislature has written a statute that does not require an act, omission, or possession.
But doesn't Section 6.01A provide that?
Right. So this is the question that I was asking myself today, Justice Basil, is what happens if this case goes to a jury and the jury is instructed, and they're instructed in 6.01A, and they're also instructed that it's a crime to intend to finance this money. Well, first of all, it's confusing to a jury because on the one hand, they're told that there has to be conduct, bodily movement, and on the other hand, they're told that it's sufficient, that they must convict the defendant if the defendant intended to do something. So that's the first thing, is it would be confusing to a jury. And the second thing is that I believe that in that case, the state would make the same argument that they're making here. They would argue to the jury that intending is an act. Intending is conduct. Intending is somehow bodily movement, though I don't see how they can possibly make that argument. The legislature did didn't give us an act in the statute, in the particular statute. And while it is elsewhere in a penal code, the requirement for an act, that doesn't validate this particular statute. Because the statute is the statute. The statute forbids intending. That a jury would also be informed there has to be conduct doesn't save the statute. Is that
But the Court of Criminal Appeals says in in Alford that 6.01 superimposes an engage in conduct requirement onto every offense.
Okay.
So why doesn't 6.01 superimpose an engage in conduct requirement on the statute you're arguing about?
I'm not sure the answer to that, and I'll have to follow up with the court on that. I don't know that I've read Alford recently. Let me take a shot at it, though, unless the court has other more pressing questions before I, you know, before I exercise my powers on this question. The question that I would pose in response is how. How is the jury told that this conduct supersedes the mere intent?
Not supersedes, superimposes.
Well, one statute superimposes itself on another.
We're reading, essentially, my understanding is we're reading the statute that you're challenging in paramateria with 6.01.
Right. So how? But it has. If we all agree that to intend is not conduct, that to intend is not bodily movement, and I think that if we have a disagreement about that, I'm happy to talk about it, but I think that reasonable people can agree that intending something does not itself, without the superimposition of 6.01, does not itself involve bodily conduct. Okay, so Court of Criminal Appeals in Alford says that 6.01 superimposes upon that a requirement of bodily movement, of an act. Well, what act, and how does the jury know? In Kirsch versus State, the Court of Criminal Appeals, in I think it was 2012, said that a trial court can't instruct a jury on judicial glosses. Not that the trial court can't. That if a trial court instructs the jury on a judicial gloss on a statute, that is where the judiciary has said, well, this is what we believe the statute to mean, that that may be an improper comment on the weight of the evidence. So what I take that to mean is that a trial court is going to give the jury the instructions as they're written in the statute, and it would be unwise to add to those instructions anything that a court of appeals or even the Court of Criminal Appeals has said about what those words mean, and let the jury sort the words out. A jury trying to sort out these words, okay, intent, intended, a person intended, you have to find the person guilty if the person intended. I think that in the real world, in the practical world, which is in jury instructions, which is what we have to look at from the beginning to the end of a case in deciding how we're going to investigate it and how we're going to argue it and what witnesses we're going to marshal, that the jury instructions at the end of the day are going to instruct a jury, if you believe beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant intended to invest in illegal activity, then you have to find her guilty. And I think that that's going to trump anything that they've seen before in the definitions about any offense requiring conduct or an act omission or possession and bodily movement. But let me give it some more thought. I can tell, Justice Birdwell, that you're skeptical.
Here's a question I have. Given the fact that intent ordinarily, if we're talking about intent mens rea-wise, is ordinarily determined either from a expression of that intent, but quite often is not an expression of the intent. Quite often what we're talking about is circumstantial evidence from which we can divine intent, okay? It seems to me that we end up conflating mens rea intent with actus reus intend, because the evidence that would be circumstantial evidence of mens rea ends up providing the actus reus for intend. And you end up conflating the two.
That in many cases there will be acts that show the underlying intent.
In other words, I've opened my bank account statement, and I have seen how much money is in my statement, and I make a notation as to this would be available if I'm going to take a trip somewhere, okay? Then that would be something that would be evidence, circumstantial evidence, of an intent to take a trip with those funds, okay, which might be evidence with regard to intent on the other portion of the statute that you're not challenging, but it might also be sufficient to get you into the intend on the portion of the statute that you are challenging, but even though you may never actually move the funds.
I get that, and I think that it presupposes that the intend is actually can actually be an actus reus. I don't think we can presuppose that. I think the legislature has meant to create what turns out to be a pure thought crime. Here's the problem with criminalizing intent is I might intend to commit a crime on one day and the next day think better of it. I might make that notation on my checking statement, and the next day I might say, ooh, no, I really don't want to do that thing that I'm not supposed to do, and abandon the plans. Well, the problem with the thought crime is that I've already committed the crime, and even though no act is done in the future, no act is intended in the future after that day, I can be prosecuted for it. I think this is why Western law requires an actus reus, is because human minds can change, and if a person intends to do something one day, you don't punish a person for what they thought on that day when they made that notation. We punish people for their acts that are made real in the real world, that are brought out and that harm the peace and dignity of the state. But just intending to commit a crime doesn't hurt anybody and doesn't offend the peace and dignity of the state. And I'll be honest with you, I may be unusual, but I've had lots of times where I've thought, I'm going to do a bad thing to a person. And I've always abandoned the plans. Well, why do I abandon the plans? Because that's what it means to be a civilized member of society. It's not that we don't ever think about doing bad things. I hope it's not that we should never think about doing bad things. It's that we never do the bad things that we think about doing. We might daydream about robbing a bank and moving off to Costa Rica, and we might even look at hypothetically at extradition policies between various places. No crime is committed, and no crime should be committed, because we should have the freedom to imagine even bad things, because imagining doing bad things is what allows us to get on track to do good things, to do proper things, to treat the people around us well. If we can't picture ourselves sinning, then how do we treat people well? If we can't picture ourselves treating people badly, then how do we know whether our behavior now is proper or not? So, I'm getting into the philosophical weeds here. I think that the legal question here is, does Section 6.01's superimposition of the conduct requirement mean that the statute at issue here actually requires proof of some conduct? And I think that the answer to that is no, it doesn't. It's you know, the Court of Criminal Appeals, and I'd have to look at the context of Alford, but it can't have been the situation that the jury was instructed on a thought crime and also had a conduct instruction, and that the Court of Criminal Appeals assumed that the jury followed the conduct, the 6.01 instruction, rather than the thought crime instruction. It can't have been that case. And I almost know that it wasn't that case, because this is not an issue that continues popping up. The legislature doesn't generally make thought crimes. They don't generally make it a crime to intend to commit a crime. This is a one-off. And because it's a one-off, it makes it easy for this court to send it back to the legislature and say, you know what, you didn't have any grown-ups in the room when you were writing the statute. We understand that. You weren't thinking about thought crimes. Your intent was not to commit a pure produce a pure intent crime, but you can't do that. And I know that this court is willing to send things back to the legislature, because it recently did in Barton, where it said to the legislature, look, this statute is unconstitutional. This court is not afraid to do that, and that's what the court should do in this case. And what we're asking for the court to do is to hold that that portion of the statute, only that portion of the statute, is unconstitutional and send it back to the trial court for dismissal of the indictments. What the state can then do is re-indict, alleging everything but that portion of the statute. And if you look at the indictments, they have alleged not only the intent, but also investment with the intent. And certainly, they can plead that portion of the statute if they can prove it. But I think that the fact that they didn't just avoid all this trouble by amending the indictments to strike the intend language suggests that they're very dependent on that. And I think that the fact that the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office's forfeiture section is here in strength tells us what's really going on here, which is they have money and they want to find an excuse under the Texas Penal Code, which requires money laundering, to hold on to that money for themselves. And with that, I'm going to sit down and I'll be back to respond to the state's arguments. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Please. Thank you, Your Honor. Before I begin, I just want to say the asset forfeiture is here because my best friend is an asset forfeiture, and she's here on my behalf. Yes, you know, that's why they're here. So okay. May it please the court. My name is Andrea Jacobs, and I'm here on behalf of the state, the appellee in this matter. Because this is a pretrial facial constitutional challenge, there's really only three questions here. One, can the verb intend define an action that's more than mere thought? Two, can the verb intend be an actus reus? And three, is there a valid application of this statute if intend it defines an action more than mere thought? So first, the verb intend does define action that's more than mere thought. In my brief, I do have the definitions of intend, to propose, to design. I really don't wish to rehash that here, but I'd like to point out that there are other statutes that use intend in this manner. It may not be the direct actus reus, but one particular statute is in the sex offender registration statute, Article 62.051F of the Code of Criminal Procedure requires registration if a person resides or intends to reside for more than 7 days. Now, if we were to look and say intend is a mere thought crime, it's just mere thought, nothing more than thought, then what that statute says is, okay, every time you think, hey, I want to move, then you have to re-register. And that's absurd. That's not what the legislature intended, and they didn't intend for this to be just a thought here as well.
Has any court interpreted that distinction with regard to that statute that we're being asked to interpret here?
There are several cases about the sufficiency of the evidence on those intend to reside. And I have one here that in Webster v. State, it's an unpublished 2017 case out of Texarkana. It's 2017 Westlaw 4937994. And in that case, the state tried to prove that he intended to reside somewhere for more than 7 days. And their evidence was this pre-release form where it says, I expect to live there. And the court talked about it and said, you know what? That may show that you intended to live there for, you know, just when you got out, but it didn't prove anything. It didn't prove you were there for more than 4 days. It didn't prove the intent. So you may have thought about it. It doesn't say those words. But if you read it, it talks about that's not sufficient evidence. So I think that case demonstrates that for sufficiency purposes, we're not just looking at thoughts, but we're looking actually more action. Like the state was required to prove not only.
There wasn't an actual constitutional, facial constitutional challenge to the intending to reside as a thought crime.
No. The only facial constitutional challenges or constitutional challenges to that statute have been to what reside means and to the fact of like what additionally you have to do and why what report means. Nothing as to the intend to reside. There's never been an actual attack on the intend in that usage.
Okay. So if Webster takes the position that even if you have filled out a document that says I intend to move to this place for whatever the required amount of time is, that in and of itself, even though that is an act, because you have filled out a form, you have expressed an intent, if you will, you have proposed, you have resolved to do something, okay, but you actually have not done that thing, then at least the Texarkana Court of Appeals has said that that's not enough to even prove that you intended.
The form said that I expect to live there. And the court said it may be evidence of your intent to live there, but it's not your evidence that you intended to live there for 7 days. So it did say that that may be evidence, but it just wasn't evidence to prove what the state was trying to prove, because it just, you know, it didn't go to the entire, it didn't prove the intent of 7 days, like they intended for 7 days. But it shows that they do consider there's different sufficiency claims regarding whether the state can prove in those cases how long, how before, when did they intend to reside, you know, if they've been evicted, things like that, and they go through and they discuss what evidence is required to prove that they've intended in these different cases under that provision.
So there's been some constitutional challenge with regard to what it means to reside. And in this particular instance, the evidence that's being discussed is with regard to the intent to reside for the length of time for 7 days. So the actual question is whether or not the I expect to live there was sufficient evidence of intending to reside for 7 days.
Yes.
Okay.
And the evidence said, and the court said, that may be evidence of your intending to reside. But then, you know, it didn't have the 7 days. If the document had said 7 days on it, it may be different. But it points out that in these types of cases, that intend actually is something more than just a mere thought. They're actually looking at what you have to show that you actually are intending something, separate than he was just thinking about it. The state submits that intend is actually just the intend to finance or invest is the voluntary conduct in preparation for the offense. For example, intend to reside in the sex offender registration statute means that you intend to reside. You've taken the voluntary conduct, you've filed a paper, you've given notice, you've bought, you know, you've rented, leased, things like that. That's stuff that those court cases have spoken about, where you're, you know, you've actually shown that you're going to take that next step. And here, where we're actually talking about intending to finance or invest. Now, this is a pretrial writ. This is not post-trial. We don't know what the state's evidence is going to be. And after the state's evidence is presented and after the appellant is convicted, if the appellant is convicted, and she feels that she's been convicted of a thought crime, then she can proceed to the court and say, hey, the evidence is insufficient. It proved I committed a thought crime, or she can also make an as-applied challenge based on the facts in that case. But as for here, the term intend to finance or invest is an action, and it's more than just a mere thought crime. Therefore, this court should find that it defines an action at least beyond the mere thought.
Counsel, let's say we disagree with you. Okay. What's the remedy? And Ms. Couch is asking for dismissal of the indictments. Can those indictments be re-urged or new indictments limited solely to the part of the statute that they're not challenging? Or does our finding in their favor with regard to the thought crime allegation effectively eviscerate the entirety of the statute and make the prosecution impossible from that point?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm just looking at the facial challenge, and the facts of this case, I'm not real deep involved in that. I'm just looking at the words on the paper,
okay.
So I don't know.
Okay.
I don't even know what the statute of limitations or anything or when this offense occurred other than when I put it in my initial.
Okay.
I think we did respond to a motion, but I don't recall. I'm sorry. I'm trying to think.
Not a problem, counsel.
So regarding the phrase intend to finance or invest and whether it can be an actus reus, I believe that the jurisprudence supports that it can. Now, the intend to finance or invest is a preparatory offense. Just like every other preparatory offense, like attempt. Now, Chapter 15 is not exclusive to the preparatory offenses. It is generally for felonies, but it only applies when the offense is charged under that chapter. In Edwards v. State, the Eastland Court in 2016, 487 Southwest 3rd, 330-336, it's discussing a case out of the Health and Safety Code. It discusses how, and it's on a jury charge issue, that Chapter 15 only applies when the offense is charged through that. If the statute itself includes the preparatory offense in the statute, then Chapter 15 does not apply. And even if Chapter 15 was something, it was inconsistent with our statute, the 3402, we do have an issue, like it's the more specific statute. So if there is some sort of inconsistency regarding the intent as a preparatory offense and attempt as Chapter 15, then we submit that under in pari materia principle that it should actually control, 3402 should control.
Counsel, even in the context of a crime that involves conspiracy, you still have to have one overt act where you demonstrate that you're part of the conspiracy to commit the crime. And that has to be conduct. That's not just generally, I'm behind you.
Well, and I think that the intent actually is an action here where you have to take acts. Now, a good example is like if you look at the changes in 05 when they created this, intend to finance or invest, they also changed subsection B. Subsection B is about undercover police officers. And if you look at it in context, and you're looking at it, a perfect example of an act intending to finance or invest is a situation where you have this undercover police officer who you think you're paying, you're intending to finance or invest, you're giving them money, but they are a police officer, so you're not financing or investing. Subsection B supports this position because in B it added and amended to say that there was a presumption that you knew that money was for criminal activity when the police officer told you so. Now, to prove intend to finance or invest, you also prove that second prong, that you knew the money was going for bad things, and that B, when they added that, that took that and said, okay, even though you really weren't, the presumption is you believed you were when a police officer told you. But it doesn't take away from the first one. So the argument is, well, the intend to finance or invest, you're turning that money over, you're trying to turn that money, you're making action, you're showing, you know, there's, it's not just you're thinking about it, there's actually more action here. And I think that's a good example of where we have an act of intending to finance or invest.
But in handing the money to the officer, you're actually financing.
Well,
in handing the money, you're actually investing.
No.
It's not a matter of intent at that point in time.
No, because the officer, you're not financing or investing anything.
Well, I understand, but B is there to make it clear that when you do that, okay, you are doing actively what you could do, and you're using an officer of the law, law enforcement, as an agent to do what you're doing, what you want to do, to finance, etc.
B only goes to that second prong about your belief, not to the actual finance or intent. Like in finance or invest, it goes to that second prong with that you further believe.
Okay.
And so when they added that, they didn't say that you also, it's as if you're financing or investing. So you can see that a defendant, the first thing they'll say is, I didn't actually finance or invest anything because it was a police officer, but I intended to. Other actions where you're sitting, a situation where, you know, I'm going to get the money, I take the money out, I try to transfer the money, but the internet goes down. And therefore, I'm unable to complete that transaction. I've intended to do it. I've taken overt actions to do it. These are all voluntary conduct in preparation of the offense. But, excuse me, I did not actually finance or invest. I intended to, and the evidence shows that. Regarding whether or not the evidence is sufficient, that's an issue that would come later, not for the facial constitutionality of this statute, because we're looking at just the words. And intending to finance or invest is like to propose, to design, is actual, we're doing things, we're taking action, you know, towards financing and investing. We may not have gotten there, but the legislature said, well, intending to finance or invest is enough. Like you're actually showing there's, you know, and so it could be a sufficiency challenge later. You could say the state didn't prove it, like in those cases with the sex offender registration, where you have those cases they say the state didn't prove I intended to reside. Well, they looked at it and said, nope, the state didn't. Just in that situation, but here, based on the words, intending to invest or reside, the word intend is an action verb, is something that where you're acting on your intent, you're doing a voluntary conduct, a preparatory offense, where you're trying to complete the offense and you weren't able to complete it for some reason. The Court of Criminal Appeals in Florney, they discuss that they have some useful language about that line of attempt and mere preparatory conduct. They talk about, and this is Florney, 1984, 668, Southwest 2nd, 380, Penn site 383. In that case, they actually, in this sufficiency case, they talk about how, you know, we have this imaginary line from non-criminal conduct to criminal conduct. Now, your criminal conduct, you got your attempts. That's the far end where you've got the criminal conduct. They mention mere preparatory conduct, and they say it's usually non-criminal. But they don't say it's not non-criminal. They just say it's usually non-criminal. And you have this line, and that line, on a case-by-case basis, you're going to look at the case, you're going to look at the evidence and all that. But that's an evidentiary thing. When you're looking at this intent and whether it's a mere thought crime, well, that's something of sufficiency, because based on intent right now, it's an action. It's to propose, to design. It's the situation where you're going towards what you want, but you're unable to complete. And so that would be something that could be raised later, sufficiency, as applied challenge. But here, it should be the legislature intended for intend to finance or invest to be a preparatory offense that should be charged at the same level as a regular one. And I believe I'm almost out of time. Finally, I just want to say the valid application, the undercover police officer situation is a valid application. The court shouldn't find that this is a thought crime. They should have find it's actually an action. It's not a thought crime. Therefore, we need one valid application to overcome the facial challenge. And that would be your undercover sting. You would be situations where people are trying. They've taken the money out. They've taken overt actions and everything, but they didn't complete. That would be an action of intending to finance. We couldn't prove finance or invest, but we can prove intending to finance. You know, that's the situation where it's not like they backed off. It's not like they were thinking about it in their armchair. They actually were taking actions. And in those situations, I believe, are valid applications of this statute. And with that, we argue that the court should find that it's facially constitutional. The state prays that the court will overrule applicants' appeal, presented issues, and affirm the trial court's denial of her pretrial petition for writ of habeas corpus. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. May it please the court. That last bit was interesting, that the valid applications of the statute are the cases where the person wasn't just sitting in his armchair thinking about it, where he actually took an overt act. The state has admitted that this statute also forbids the case where the person is sitting in his armchair thinking about it. And that's what intend means. And intent is not a bodily movement. To intend is to have this mental idea that this is something that we're going to do. And intent could always change. Until the act is committed, an intent could always change. We can intend to do something and then intend to do it, and then seems like not such a good idea, I don't intend to do that anymore, and never have done anything. To intend, the state contends, is acting on an intent. I disagree. I think the dictionary is going to say that to intend is to have an intent. I think acting on the intent is taking it a step farther. It's acting. It's doing something in the real world, which is what's lacking from this portion of the statute. I looked up Alford. And Alford is actually quoting Alvarado in talking about superimposing 6.01 on all statutes. And it says, in the instant case, we find that 6.01 is superimposed on everything else. And that case was about whether the jury should be instructed on intent as to the conduct or intent as to the result, whether injury to a child was conduct a conduct-based offense or a result-based offense. The importance of this is that the court is saying not that 6.01 imposes the requirement of an act on every offense, but that 6.01 requires the superimposition of voluntariness on every offense, that in order to commit injury to a child, you have to commit a voluntary act, and you have to do it with the intent to injure the child, is what I get from Alvarado. But I'm a little bit slow, and I may not have gotten it right in the last 20 minutes. So an act, according to the code, is bodily movement. Is intending bodily movement? The state says, oh, it is bodily movement. That's what the legislature is talking about. When we have an overbreath challenge, we have to look, especially something that we contend is a thought crime or a violation of free speech, we have to look at the broadest common definitions of the terms, because we can't trust that the jury in that jury box is going to follow the narrowest definition of the terms. And as I discussed in my initial argument, a trial court is probably not going to instruct a jury on the court's definition of terms. Did you have something, Justice Birdwell?
No.
Okay. To attempt requires an act. To engage in a conspiracy requires an act. To solicit requires an act. It's a speech act, but it's an act nonetheless. All of these things are things that could be observed by other people, right? All of the inchoate offenses require something, an overt act, or a communication that is something that could conceivably be observed by other people, or could be recorded on a telephone line, or could be, you know, written down.
What is the distinction, in your view, that she's raising with regard to subpart B, handing money or something to law enforcement, undercover law enforcement? How do those interrelate?
So handing money to undercover law enforcement includes an act, and it's more like an attempt. When the state was describing subsection B, I thought, well, that's just an attempt, right? Where we have the intent to commit the crime, we act to commit the crime by handing the money to undercover law enforcement. We're just foiled by circumstances. We've taken substantial steps amounting to more than mere preparation to commit the crime. And so I think that subsection B tells us that that's not part of the intent crime, of the thought crime, that the fact that we have to talk separately about giving money to an undercover officer doesn't say that the legislature intended an act in every instance. It just says, in this particular instance, here's how a crime is committed. Does that answer the question, Justice Birdwell?
I think so.
Okay. Unless the court has more questions, I'm drive home now.
Okay. All righty.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate
so
it.
Much. The case is submitted. Thank you for your arguments. And we will adjourn at this time.